Good morning and welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk show. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. In 1998, two Houston men were arrested and charged with having sex. And that was a violation of Texas law. A lot of people thought it was an unjust law and had been looking for an opportunity to challenge it. When they heard about it, gay rights activists took up this case. And when it was all over, the U.S. Supreme Court had overturned the Texas law and similar laws in 12 other states. This was in 2003. And this is the standard, very brief sketch, thumbnail sketch, of the case of Lawrence v. Texas. But there is a lot more to this story than that. And in this part of Focus, we will be talking with Dale Carpenter. He's professor of law at the University of Minnesota Law School. And he is the author of a recently published book that explores this case, goes into some of the background. The title of his book is Flagrant Conduct, The Story of Lawrence v. Texas, and it is published by W.W. Norton. The book presents some rather surprising features of this case, including the willingness of the two men who were charged to admit to something that they did not do in order to make this challenge to an unjust law. It's a fascinating story. As we explore it, questions certainly will be welcome. We just ask people to try to be brief so we can keep our program moving. But callers are welcome. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free, 800-222-9455 is the number to use if it would be a long-distance call. And we do also have email, so you may send a question that way, will-talk@illinois.edu. At any point here, you are certainly welcome to call. And Professor Carpenter, hello.
Hello.
Thanks very much for talking with us. We certainly appreciate it.
I'm glad to be here.
Well, just before we go into the story, and there really are three main sections here in the book, things that you deal with. Partly it is how the law in America over time has looked at sexual behavior. Partly it's the event here that's at the heart of Lawrence v. Texas. And then there's the court case. Overall, I guess I should give you the opportunity to talk about just why it is that Lawrence is an important case in the history of civil rights in this country.
Well, it is one of the most important constitutional rights decisions of the past 50 years. I'd say it's the most important gay rights decision that we have yet had from the Supreme Court. So that puts its place in history, and I think the reason for that, especially for the latter point, is that it really eradicated about 400 years worth of laws that had targeted certain sexual activities outside of traditional procreative marital sex. And those laws had come to be targeted solely at gay sex and had allowed all others their sexual freedom. And the laws had all kinds of collateral effects on the lives of gays and lesbians. So removing them from the law books was a very big step forward for the gay rights movement, just in terms of helping to change the climate in the country and in terms of getting rid of some very bad Supreme Court precedent.
Yeah. I think it's important for people to know that as recently as 1960, every state had some kind of law criminalizing specific sexual acts, and it didn't matter who you were, gay, straight, married, single, it included everybody. And over time, many states got rid of those things, except there were places, and Texas was one of them, where they retained them, but tailored them very narrowly to apply only to gay men and lesbians.
Yes, that's exactly right. Laws, these have typically been called sodomy laws in American history, but that is a very broad stroke term to apply to a variety of non-procreative, non-marital sexual acts over our history. And in fact, by the early 1970s, for the very first time in our history, we saw laws that targeted only some sexual conduct between persons of the same sex and leaving everyone else free to have their own sexual freedom within or outside of marriage, and allowing things like heterosexual sodomy, but not homosexual sodomy. And that was a new development in American law. That was a narrowing, a targeting, a specification that we had not previously seen in American law.
Hmm. Also, an important point, I think, is that while it, apparently these laws were on the books in a lot of places, they weren't often enforced. But the fact that they were there hung over the heads of gay people, and even if the police were not going out in large numbers and arresting gay people for doing things in the privacy of their own homes, the fact that it was there was very important.
Oh yes, I mean it was the existence of an anti-homosexual sodomy law was used as a justification, or should we say, a pretext for discrimination in a limitless number of daily activities for gays and lesbians in the country. Just to give you two examples of this, the Dallas Police Department, not unlike other police departments in the country, refused to hire homosexuals, citing the Texas sodomy law, or as it was called, the homosexual conduct law, refused to hire homosexuals on the grounds that police officers should not be lawbreakers or presumptive lawbreakers under Texas law. Another example would be people who were denied housing and could be denied housing if they were in a gay relationship or with another person of the same sex, on the grounds that providing them housing would be promoting immoral and illegal conduct, as if they were going to be selling drugs out of their apartment or something. So this status was used to discriminate in the law and to deny legal protections across the board. It was rarely used actually to stop people from having sex. That was a rare thing. It happened in this case, allegedly, but that was rare. It's the insidious use of these laws in other ways that really had a harmful effect on the rights of gays and lesbians.
Just to introduce again our guest, we're talking with Dale Carpenter. He's the Earl R. Larson Professor of Civil Rights and Civil Liberties Law at the University of Minnesota Law School. And we're talking about the story of Lawrence v. Kansas, a case decided by the Supreme Court in 2003. This was very important in civil rights law history. And in this case, the court struck down the sodomy law of Texas and also a number of similar laws in other states. He writes about this in his book, Flagrant Conduct. It's published by Norton, W.W. Norton. If you'd like to read it, it's a very interesting story. And questions here, of course, I welcome 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, I mentioned that part of the book is about what exactly, on this night, this September night of 1998, what happened, what occurred. And you went to Houston, and you talked with the two men at the heart of this case, John Lawrence and Tyrone Garner, who have since passed away. But at one point, you actually were able to meet with them and talk with them about what happened. You talked with some of the police that were involved, trying to reconstruct, at least according to the people who were there, what happened. Was this something where there was, in your mind or in people's mind, actually some doubt about what actually had occurred on this night in 1998?
Oh, yes. I think there's considerable doubt about what actually occurred on the night that these two men in Houston were arrested, allegedly by the police, for allegedly having sex in violation of the homosexual conduct law. And I did interview three of the four police officers, and the story that they tell, frankly, is not credible about how it is that they came to the bedroom and began to witness these men having sex. Two of the police officers claim to have seen something, although they disagree on what sexual act they saw.
Mm-hmm.
And the two men themselves who were arrested, John Lawrence and Tyrone Garner, later denied the fact that they had been having sex after they had been arrested and after the Supreme Court decision had come down. So there's quite a bit of difference between the defendants and the police officers, and there's even some disagreement among the police officers about what happened that night. And So I do think there's considerable ground for doubting that the police ever actually saw any sex.
Yeah. This, it even begins with a spurious report. They, apparently, these two men, John Lawrence and Tyrone Garner, and a third man, a man named Robert Eubanks, were together in the apartment of Mr. Lawrence. They had been hanging out together. They'd been drinking some. There apparently was some kind of disagreement or falling out between Mr. Eubanks and Mr. Garner. Eubanks excuses himself. He leaves. He goes out. He says he's going to go to a vending machine and get himself a soft drink. But what he does is he goes and he calls the police. And he phones in this report of a black man, going crazy with a gun in this apartment. Of course, this is something the police have to take very seriously. So they respond to that as if that really was what happened.
Yes, that's right. This is a very high-stress, high-anxiety call for police to believe that there's someone, you know, threatening others with a gun inside of an apartment because they have to take care of themselves. They have to take care of other citizens who may be in harm's way. And so within minutes, really, the police officers who happened to be patrolling that immediate vicinity when the call came in turned their cars around and head into the parking lot of the apartment complex. And one of them arrives first and encounters Robert Eubanks, who's shaking and crying at the bottom of the stairs to John Lawrence's apartment. He's the one who made the call. And he points to the upstairs apartment where John Lawrence and Tyrone Garner are inside, just enjoying the evening, according to them, watching TV and so forth. And he says that's where the black man with the gun is. And by now, three or four police officers have arrived, and they decide to go up the steps in what's called a tactical stack, one right behind the other with guns drawn, ready to deal with any situation that might arise. And they do that and get to the top of the stairs and knock on the door, and the door is slightly ajar, and it opens. And they look inside, they say, and they didn't see anyone. So they began searching the apartment. They eventually made their way toward the back of the apartment, and then they come upon the door, which is open, to the very back bedroom, and they say that there, you know, in the semi-darkness of the room, they could see these two men, John Lawrence and Tyrone Garner, having sex. The other two police officers were in the other part of the apartment, so they never claimed to have seen anything. And they disagree. These two police officers who say they saw some sexual activity disagree about what they saw. At any rate, they said that they turned on the light and told the men to stop, and that the men would not stop, despite the presence of police officers in the room with the light on, with the guns drawn at them, and with the police officers shouting at them. And, in fact, one of the police officers told me that the men continued to have sex with each other for well in excess of a minute with the police officers standing there. Until finally, he said, they had to pull them apart because they wouldn't stop. And that's just an incredible story. I think most people understand, just common sense, that once police officers are at the door to the apartment, just 30 or 40 feet away, and they're shouting inside that the police department has arrived, you have more than enough time to begin to stop what you're doing and begin looking for your clothes rather than to continue. And in fact, the men themselves, John Lawrence and Tyrone Garner, pled not guilty that next morning at their arraignment.
Yeah, that's and so you as we said, you had the opportunity to talk with both of them, John Lawrence and Tyrone Garner, who told you what they experienced on that night. Clearly said, no, we were not having sex. And in fact, after they were arrested, when they appeared in court the next day. And apparently realized what they were being charged with, they were horrified, and they said, no, we weren't We weren't doing that.
That's right. Before they had any legal representation offering them advice about what to do, they both pled not guilty to the charge. John Lawrence, Tyrone Garner was never allowed by his attorneys to tell me directly that the men were not having sex. Mm. I had to draw that implication out of him through a number of questions and during our interview. But John Lawrence was finally allowed to tell his side of the story and said that they didn't realize they were even being charged with having sex until that next morning when the DA's assistant in the courtroom read the charge, the 69-word complaint that the officer that night previously had filed, and it specified that the two men had been having sex in violation of the law. And he said that's when it dawned on us that the police were telling bald-faced lies, and they voted not guilty.
Mm. And just to I want to talk some more about the circumstances, but I think probably it's an important point to make that that these two men, John Lawrence, Tyrone Garner, were not political particularly. They were not gay rights activists, that probably their initial inclination would be to hope that this could go away as quietly as possible. And they certainly, as you said, initially pled not guilty because they weren't.
Right.
But that what happened was is that people who were interested in pursuing this issue had been looking for a case that they hoped would help them make the argument that could eventually make it all the way to the Supreme Court. And when they heard about what had happened to Lawrence and Garner, they thought this could be the case that could do it.
Yes, that's exactly right. The case started out as a citation in Texas. Violating the sodomy law was not even really a jailable offense. It was an offense for which you had to pay a $200 fine, which is the equivalent of a speeding ticket, a Class C misdemeanor. So there was not very much prospect that this was going to go to the Supreme Court of the United States. And the men, because, as you say, they had no connection to the gay civil rights movement, they weren't involved in any groups or causes, never imagined that they would that this would become part of a gay rights cause. They were simply angry about what had happened to them that night. And so on the one hand, they wanted the case to go away. And on the other hand, they really didn't want to pay their fine because they said the police are making up lies about what we did because the police, they said, didn't like gay people. And so they didn't actually make a decision to challenge the constitutionality of their arrest or the law under which they were arrested until they first met with lawyers on October 12, 1998, about 3 weeks later. October 12, 1998, by the way, happens to be the day that Matthew Shepard died back then. And so it was a time of great attention to gay issues.
Mm. I mentioned that in addition to having the opportunity to speak with both Mr. Lawrence and Mr. Garner, you did also talk with some of the police officers that were involved in this event in September of 1998. And as you explained, so the police get this call of a man with a gun, which is something that they take very seriously. So a number of officers responded. And one in particular was the man who was the one who was in the lead. He was kind of in charge at the scene. This was a man named Joseph Quinn, who you talked with about this and some about his career as a police officer. He could have done several things, including done nothing, when he realized that, no, there was no man with a gun there. And, well, yes, maybe these guys were gay, but he could have just said, there's nothing going on here, turned around and left, or something not particularly serious. He certainly didn't have to arrest them and take them in. So the question is, why did he do that?
Well, that's a very good question. I devote at least a chapter to that very issue. It's an interesting one. First of all, something about this particular officer. He was called the priority unit there because he was the very first one of the four police officers to arrive. So it's basically his decision to direct the activities of the other officers, the other deputies. It's his decision whether to cite the men with violation of any law, and it's his decision whether to actually arrest them, take them out of the apartment, and take them to jail. And he decided at every single point that he would use his discretion against the men. He decided to issue them a citation and to take them to jail, which he did not have to do. He could have given them a, you know, if you've ever had a warning for a speeding ticket, for speeding instead of being given an actual ticket, he had that discretion. But he decided instead that he was going to issue them a citation. And he could have not taken them to jail for the evening, but he decided to do that as well. And the question of why really raises the question of what was going on in his mind and what was going on in the minds of the other officers that night. I think the first thing to note is that, as he himself told me, he had the largest citizen complaint file in the entire Harris County Sheriff's Office. There had been more complaints against him for abuse, for rough treatment of citizens, and I've got some stories of that in the book told by even the judge in the initial case, than any other officer. He'd been sent to anger management school. He'd been sent off patrol and back to work in the prison. He was a very, very temperamental, combustible officer who was easily offended when his authority was challenged. And his authority was challenged that night. John Lawrence did not appreciate having the police in his apartment, and he talked back to the police officers quite a bit. He called them stormtroopers and jackbooted thugs and would not go quietly when they arrested him. He said they had no right to be in his apartment. So that didn't sit well with the police officers and especially with this lead police officer. There was also the fact that there was gay erotica in the apartment. And it was obvious very quickly that these three men who'd been there were gay. Two of them were in a relationship, but not John and Tyrone. Tyrone and Robert Eubanks were. My interviews with the police officers indicated a considerable degree of homophobia, of dislike of gay people in all of the three of the four that I was able to interview that night, including in Joseph Quinn. So that element was present. Then you had the fact that one of the two men alleged to have been having sex was black and one was white. This was an area with very traditional racial attitudes. You had the fact that you would have expected the men not to fight back against a traffic ticket because they were obviously working class people. They were not very wealthy. They would not have New York and Washington, D.C. lawyers take their plea all the way to the Supreme Court. So they were fairly easy targets. And then, of course, the police were just angry and frustrated generally that they discovered when they got there was nobody with a gun. They had been called there on this frivolous argument among three men. They could have gotten someone hurt. So it was a mix of things, but homophobia played a very prominent role in my view.
And clearly here the man who set all this in motion, Robert Eubanks, the fellow who called the police and said there was this black man with a gun, clearly he was making a false report, was apparently even charged with making a false report. What were the consequences ultimately for him?
Well, he was indeed. In fact, he committed under Texas law by far the most serious offense that night, making a false report to the police. And he eventually pled guilty and was spent 2 weeks in jail for having done that. He spent his time in jail. He then continued his relationship with Tyrone Garner for the next 2 years. They lived together from house to house and went from job to job. They did not have very stable lives. And Robert Eubanks, the man who made the call, was eventually beaten to death outside of a bus stop in Houston, Texas, and was spent a few days in the hospital and then died.
So Tyrone Garner and Robert Eubanks did, or at least subsequently, have a relationship. Was there, in fact, any relationship between Tyrone Garner and John Lawrence?
None whatsoever.
Never.
They had never had sex. They didn't have sex that night. They never did afterwards. They were not. I think it's even too strong to say they were friends. They were acquaintances. Tyrone Garner and his partner Robert Eubanks would come over once a month or so to help clean out John Lawrence's apartment, and he would give them some money for having done that, similar to what they had done that day. But John Lawrence knew Robert Eubanks much better. He'd known him for about 20 years at that point that they were arrested. But Tyrone Garner, he did not know as well, and they didn't have much of any kind of contact with each other. John Lawrence, it turns out, had his own partner, which I only found out through my interviews, nobody knew about, I think, before I wrote about this case. His partner happened to be in Mexico at the time visiting his family, so he was not in the apartment that night. These men were each involved in their own relationships, not with each other.
Our guest in this hour of focus is Dale Carpenter. He is a professor of law at the University of Minnesota Law School. We're talking about some of the background behind the case of Lawrence v. Texas. He writes about that in his new book, Flagrant Conduct. We'll talk some more after a very short break. This is Focus.
Support for WILL comes from Subaru of Champaign County, featuring the standard all-wheel drive Subaru Outback with an EPA highway rating of 29 mpg, depending on conditions. More information is available at their showroom on Route 45 in Savoy or at SubaruofChampaign.com.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're here weekday mornings from 10 until noon. We have 10 different topics every week. Tomorrow morning in the 10 o'clock hour, we'll talk with writer Homer Hickam. A lot of people might know him for his memoir, Rocket Boys, that became a movie, October Sky. He's authored a number of novels. He has a new one, which is for young adult readers, and it's set on the moon in the future, 120 years in the future. The title is Crater. We'll talk a little bit about that and some of his other writing tomorrow morning at 10. Then in the second hour, the guest is Enrico Moretti. He's professor at UC Berkeley in the Department of Economics, and there we'll be talking about his book, The New Geography of Jobs, in which he makes the argument that now and even more in the future, your success is not just about who you are, but it's about where you live, especially if you happen to live in or close to cities like San Francisco, Boston, Austin, or Durham. That's tomorrow. You can check the schedule, find out what we have up for the days ahead by going to our website. That's WILL.illinois.edu. You can follow us on Twitter, Will Public Media. We are also on Facebook. In this hour of focus, the guest is Dale Carpenter. He is the Earl R. Larson Professor of Civil Rights and Civil Liberties Law at the University of Minnesota Law School. He is the author of the book Flagrant Conduct, The Story of Lawrence v. Texas, and it is published by W.W. Norton. Questions are certainly welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line that is good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. One of the aspects of the story, and you know, it sort of keeps coming up again and again, is how it is as it moves along from this September night in '98 to the point where it's heard by the Supreme Court in 2003. There seemed to be a number of points at which, if things had gone a different way, we wouldn't be talking about Lawrence v. Texas. We might be talking about something else, but not about this. And right from the beginning, it seemed almost a matter of chance that this case did indeed come to the attention of civil rights lawyers who were interested in this particular issue, because it seems that it might very well have just gone away, and you know, we would never have heard of it and wouldn't be talking about it.
Absolutely. From the very beginning, when people are arrested for a violation of this law in Texas, when they were, there was no sodomy law alert that went out to gay rights activists to tell them, here's a case, we need to challenge it. So it was just another Class C misdemeanor, a speeding ticket in the Harris County judicial system. Could easily have gone away. The men could have decided they didn't want to challenge it and just paid their fines and it would be over the way that many people had done before them. This was different this time because the arrests happened to occur in the jurisdiction of a justice of the peace, which is the lowest level court in the Texas judicial system that handles very petty crimes and speeding tickets and things of that sort. So it was in that jurisdiction of a particular judge who had a clerk who was a closeted gay man. And that clerk came in work the next morning and saw the arrest report, saw the officer who had made the charge, and could not believe his eyes. He simply could not believe that someone had been arrested for sodomy in Texas. He didn't even know it was against the law and couldn't find, when he tried to enter the charge into the judicial system, he couldn't find the number assigned for this crime. They hadn't even used one ever. So he was quite surprised by that, and so he called his partner of 10 years at that point and told him about what had happened. And it turns out his partner was a closeted official in the sheriff's department that had made the arrest. So here you've got these two closeted gay men deep inside the Harris County judicial system who have this knowledge of this arrest. But even they didn't know that there was a potential Supreme Court significance to this arrest. So they just treated it as an oddity. But that night, which would have been the night after the arrest, they went to a gay bar where they would go on a weekly basis to have a couple of drinks and chat with the bartender there. While they were chatting with the bartender, they happened to mention that this arrest had occurred. And this caused the bartender's eyes to light up, because this was not just any bartender. He was himself a gay rights activist. And in fact, he's now the Harris County chairman of the Democratic Party. But in 1998, he was a bartender. And when he heard this, he immediately realized, this is a potential lawsuit. And that's when he alerted the lawyers in the area to take the case, and they were quite excited about it, I think, really from the very beginning, and realized it had potential.
Yeah. I'm sure there also were, if you look at the prosecutor side of this, there would be places where a state's attorney or a district attorney would look at this case and see nothing but trouble.
Yeah.
And would want to do anything he or she could to make it go away. And it seems like, though, unfortunately for the history of law, maybe you won't say unfortunate, but as far as the district attorney there in Harris County went, he couldn't. And once it became public, they had to go ahead with the prosecution.
Yes, there are a couple of ways to look at that. One is that is absolutely right. Once this matter went public, because the Harris County district attorney is elected in partisan elections, it is very difficult for the Harris County district attorney not to defend the Texas sodomy law, because that is an important thing, was an important matter of the party platform for the Republican Party in Texas. And they were absolutely opposed to any effort to repeal the sodomy law in Texas. And he was an elected, you know, countywide Republican official. So once this went public, it was the district attorney's office was really backed into a corner and politically had to support the law. Now, having said that, it is possible for prosecutors simply to urge a judge to dismiss a prosecution if, for example, they don't believe the story that the police officers tell, or they simply think it will be so expensive to defend the case it's not worth the time and effort of the office to try to defend it. And here, any prosecutor could have done that with this case on his own. It turns out that one of the early prosecutors who had a decision to make about whether to continue prosecuting this case was a closeted lesbian. She was the one who prosecuted the case in the county criminal court, one of the lowest courts in the Texas judicial system. And she kept the case alive by continuing to prosecute it. she was doing her job, she said, and it was at least she played at least some role in helping to keep this case alive by continuing to press it. So you had a lesbian prosecuting two gay men for violating a homosexual conduct law.
Mm. And then to have the maximum impact, obviously the people who were interested in getting this heard at the highest level, that of course what they wanted to happen was for this to go to the United States Supreme Court. And at one point it also looked as if it might not, because at one point an appeals court actually found for Lawrence and Gardner, and it could have been right then that could have been the end, and again we never would have been talking about Lawrence v. Texas.
Mm-hmm. That's right. So after it went through this lesbian prosecutor's court, where the men were finally duly convicted and fined and had their convictions entered upon the record, they appealed to the appeals court in Houston. And the appeals court, in a three-judge panel, listened to the arguments that were made by Lambda Legal, which was the national gay rights organization representing the men in their challenge to the sodomy law, and heard the arguments by the Harris County District Attorney's Office on whether the law was unconstitutional. And the Lambda Legal attorneys argued in part that the law was unconstitutional because it violated a Texas Equal Rights Amendment that had made sex discrimination unconstitutional. And they argued that these homosexual conduct laws were a form of sex discrimination because whether you were convicted or not depended on what your sex was or what the sex of your partner was, and so that's sex discrimination. That was a creative use of the laws. No other court had accepted that kind of use of the law, or very few had. And frankly, the district attorney's office didn't think it would be very successful. But two of the three judges on this court, all of whom were elected Republicans, decided they did believe that argument. They thought that argument made a lot of sense. So they held the law unconstitutional under the Texas Constitution, which, if that had held, would have invalidated the state sodomy law on state constitutional grounds, but would not have taken care of sodomy laws across the country. So they were in this odd position. The gay rights attorneys are in this odd position of having gained this unexpected, wonderful victory in Texas, but not being able really to apply this victory all across the land, which is what they wanted to do. And it could have stopped there again, except that, once again, political reaction came into play. Once the two judges issued their opinion, they were vociferously criticized by the Texas Republican Party, which happened to have its state convention the weekend after the decision came down. And the state convention issued a rebuke to the judges and urged the full appeals court to reconsider the matter and reverse what they had done. And that's precisely what they proceeded to do. Without hearing any argument, without having any further briefing, by a vote of 7-2, that intermediate appeals court reversed the decision, and that allowed the case to proceed.
We are coming into about our last 10 minutes on the program here. This is Focus, and we're talking with Dale Carpenter. He's professor of law at the University of Minnesota Law School, and we're talking about the case of Lawrence v. Texas, heard by the U.S. Supreme Court 2003. They struck down the sodomy law of Texas, and also because there were some other similar laws in other states, in effect, struck them down as well. It's a very, very interesting story when you follow the path from the initial event that took place in 1998 to when the court heard the case in 2003. And the story is told in the book Flagrant Conduct, and it's published by W.W. Norton. So if you'd like to read the story, you can do that. And again, questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. So when eventually, after now some years, the case goes to the Supreme Court, there were maybe the two ways the court could look at it or identify two issues as being key. One would be they could look at it as a matter of privacy. The other way they could look at it is as a matter of equal protection. And you might, based on the previous court's finding that gay people had no right to privacy, essentially, in their sex lives, you would think that the court would look at this as a matter of equal protection and would go back to this issue that says, well, you know, you can't criminalize something for just some people. You've got to be even-handed in the way that you do that. So, and but in fact, they did approach it as a privacy issue. And maybe then for people to understand that, you have to go back a little bit and talk about an earlier ruling of the court. This is the case of Bowers v. Hardwick.
Yes, that's right. In 1986, the court in Bowers versus Hardwick had upheld by a 5-4 decision the Georgia sodomy law. And in doing so, they had firmly held that there was no right to privacy that protected homosexual conduct under the Constitution. And in fact, they said arguments to the contrary were, to use the court's words, at best facetious. So that was a stinging rebuke to the rights, constitutional rights of gay men and lesbians around the country. And that decision became influential because it was used by courts in a lot of areas of the law, from custody to employment, some of the areas I mentioned before, to justify discrimination against gay men and lesbians, to refuse to extend civil rights protections to gay men and lesbians. A presumptive criminal class had no extra protection in the law from discrimination. So that decision was a big barrier, and I think going into this case, certainly the gay rights attorneys would like to have reversed that decision and had the court come out in favor of the liberty of these men to their own sexual intimacy and reverse that Bowers versus Hardwick decision. But they honestly believed, and I believed going in, that the better chance was to say that the Texas law was especially unconstitutional, or in particular unconstitutional, because on its face it aimed only at homosexual sex. It did not deal with any other sexual activity. And so it was a violation of the Constitution's command that people be treated given the equal protection of the law. And five of the justices, it turns out, decided to reverse the decision in Bowers versus Hardwick, which was a very significant moment in the history of the Supreme Court, to have the court reverse itself on a major constitutional issue in this way. And ultimately did hold that the liberty protected by the Constitution did guarantee the certain private intimate choices by gay people as well as by straight people. Now, Justice O'Connor added a sixth vote in which she decided the issue on equal protection grounds, that you couldn't have one law for gay people and another law for straight people. But five of the justices did, in fact, overrule Bowers versus Hardwick.
Mm-hmm. And I suppose that those people who were interested in defending the Texas law weren't particularly helped by the fact that the attorney who ended up making that argument, it was, in fact, the district attorney for Harris County and not someone who would have been experienced in making arguments in this venue.
Yes, that's right. Well, you know, he had he was a good, very good trial lawyer, jury trial lawyer, and he'd been elected to be the Harris County District Attorney, and he could have turned this argument over to outside expert people. He could have let it be handled by one of his assistants in the office who really did understand the case and understood the law. But even though he'd had very little contact with the case and very little direct involvement, he decided to argue this case himself, being the elected head of the district attorney's office. And as I say, he was a very accomplished trial lawyer, but he had very little or no appellate experience and no experience in front of the Supreme Court. And you do not want to make your appellate debut in the United States Supreme Court. You need to have something ahead of that. By way of experience, it's a high-pressure atmosphere. And he was just clearly outmatched. He did not understand much of the law that he was arguing. He was ignorant of some of it. And almost from the beginning, the judges were frustrated with the arguments he was making and the responses he was giving to questions. Even Justice Scalia, who was clearly on his side, was obviously perturbed by his lack of knowledge and preparation.
We have about 5-6 minutes left. We have a couple of callers. We'll bring them in. They can help us by trying to be brief as well. First up is Leroy and line number one. Hello.
Yes, good morning. Fascinating discussion. I look forward to reading the book. I had a broader question as how some of this would apply to other rights of individuals, in the privacy of their bedroom. A particular case in point I'm thinking of is, maybe polygamous relationships. And I'll just leave it at that and listen. Thank you.
All right.
Yes. Well, the Supreme Court decision, this book really isn't so much about analyzing the future under the Supreme Court decision. It's about analyzing and presenting what got us to the decision. But there is a little bit in the book about that. I think the Supreme Court's decision deals not directly, certainly, with a marriage case. So to the extent someone wanted recognition for a polygamous marriage, that would probably be another large step the Supreme Court would have to take beyond Lawrence versus Texas. And indeed, there's the argument now is whether its principles extend to marriage simply between same-sex couples. The court was careful in its decision, however, to say that adults have privacy, intimacy inside of the home that the state cannot control. And to the extent that people were in a polyamorous relationship but not demanding marital recognition, Lawrence might well extend some protection to them if they were subject to laws to the contrary. There is a section of the opinions that very carefully limits the extent of it. It says this is not a case involving minors. It is not a case involving prostitution. It is not a case involving coercion. So all of those things are left out of this decision by the Supreme Court. And big part of the decision really rests on the dignity of gay persons and their need to be able to form lasting relationships, of which sex is one important part.
Well, given that, though, can you imagine extending the argument? And if you were going to make the argument for gay marriage, you use Lawrence as a platform to stand on?
Yes, you certainly can. There are parts of the opinion that speak in terms of the dignity and equality of gay relationships that compare the relationships of two gay people to a married couple, for example. The court in Bowers versus Hardwick, the 17-year-old decision that was overruled, really only saw gay people as having sex. Lawrence versus Texas sees gay people as having relationships, of which sex is a part. And if you look at the decision, you read the decision, you can see the influence that the briefing in the case had on the Supreme Court's opinion. It very much emphasized the relationship, the importance to relationships of a private, intimate life. And I think that lends support to the idea that these relationships are important, they contribute, they're important in the lives of the people who have them, and part of the way we could respect those relationships is by granting them the status of marriage. Now, at the same time, the court has a couple of passages where it says we're not dealing today with the question of whether the state must grant formal recognition to these relationships. So that's going to require further argument in the Supreme Court if and when a marriage case comes before it.
Yeah. We'll try and get one more caller here very quickly. Orland Park, line four. Hello.
Yes, hello. A couple of thoughts came to mind. It's a very interesting discussion. One would be if you could address which particular judges were, maybe changed their mind, because it seems to me most unusual that the Supreme Court would reverse itself within a generation. And the second question is related to that first one. Are there any other cases that come to mind where the Supreme Court has reversed itself so significantly within a generation? And I'll listen on the radio.
Yeah, and those are excellent questions. I wish I could give you more than about a minute.
Okay. Well, it is the case that the judges changed their minds, I think. And the way that we know that happened is that a judge in 1986 told one of his clerks when he was trying to decide how to decide the case, that he couldn't make a decision because he didn't understand gay people because he'd never met one. It turns out the clerk that he was speaking to was a closeted gay person. The judges didn't have any openly gay clerks, and just didn't have the experience with gay people that they would come to have by 2003. And in 2003, Paul Smith, who argued the case for Lawrence and Garner, got up, as he was about to get up, had someone whisper in his ear that Justice O'Connor had sent a baby shower gift to her former clerk and her lesbian partner. So that's a dramatic shift in the court. And I think it was the court coming to appreciate the realities of modern American life. As to a shift within a generation of this magnitude, I would have to think much. I'd have to have a lot longer to think about that. None comes to my head right off the top of my head.
All right. Well, but I think just very quickly, I think that what it says is that as much as we sort of say the court is supposed to be above it all, that's really not the case at all. And then, in fact, the court is sensitive to public opinion. And or at least has seems to have demonstrated some sensitivity to public opinion.
It also brings its own, the justices bring their own life experience to bear in their decisions. That is inescapable. And knowing gay people, you know, makes you more predisposed to believing that they should have equal dignity and rights.
Yeah. It's a really interesting story, and there's more even than we have talked about here this morning in this hour. So for folks who have been listening, I would say take a look at the book. It is titled Flagrant Conduct, The Story of Lawrence v. Texas. It is published by W.W. Norton by our guest Dale Carpenter. He is professor of law at the University of Minnesota. And Professor Carpenter, thank you very much.
Thank you. My pleasure to be with you.